Welcome to A Break in the Action, where we take a break from the business of our days to focus on outdoor pursuits and the traditional sporting lifestyle. Join us for discussion and interviews on vintage and modern break action shotguns, sporting literature, outdoor leisure, and reviews of best-in-class gear, accessories, and destinations. So pour yourself a drink, sit back, relax, and let's take a break in the action. Now here's your host, shotgun collector, wing shooter, and sporting clays enthusiast, Ryan Dowdy.
Well, fall is in full swing, and what a great time of year. Don't you love it? Hunting seasons of all varieties are in, the leaves are falling, the weather is beginning to turn, and Halloween is just around the corner. Several weeks ago, when brainstorming episode ideas for this October, a thought popped into my head. Frankenstein's monster was stitched together components that formed a man. What if we could do the same and cobble together components to build a shotgun? Would the end result be greater than the sum of its individual parts? Or would the sight of it scare children and civilized shotgun enthusiasts? Now, we all know that with regards to shotguns, it's always been the case that with deep enough pockets, you could go to any manufacturer and have them build you a bespoke gun with any feature that they offer. That isn't what we're doing today. Today, I'm joined by my friend Johnny Carter from TGS Outdoors, and we're going to cherry pick components, features, options, and embellishments from any and all manufacturers and from all eras to each build up a Frankenstein's monster shotgun. This fictitious shotgun could end up being an absolute dream gun, or it could just be something odd and interesting that we'd love to see built. Johnny has handled, shot, and taken apart shotguns from most manufacturers, both modern and vintage. I couldn't think of anyone better to join on this call. He and I had a ton of fun in putting this episode together, but I must warn you, this one is for the shotgun nerds. Most minds don't just sit around and think about shotguns in this way, and as you'll see, we get off into the weeds a bit. Our conversations stretch for nearly 2 hours, so this is going to be a two-parter. So as you're always instructed to do in the intro, pour yourself a drink, sit back, and relax while we each create an enthusiast dream shotgun, or possibly a steel and wood monstrosity. Well, that's our cue, I guess. Johnny, thanks for helping out with this one. This is going to be fun.
No, thank you very much, man. There aren't many podcasts on our kind of stuff, is there? There's a lot on hunting, a lot on guns.
Right, right.
But I appreciate you. Thank you for existing in return.
You bet. You bet. Well, I'm not sure exactly where we start with an episode like this, but I think I want to begin by each of us just giving an overview of the gun that we're going to be creating. I'll start us off. My gun will be an over and under, a game, or a field over and under to be specific. It'll be a 20 gauge, and it will be a side lock as opposed to a box lock. Johnny, what are the general specs of the shotgun that you're going to be stitching together for us?
This is an awesome subject, and I have racked my brain a lot about it because we probably could have gone through each kind of gun type by type. And a semi-automatic would be a really fun one. But an over and under 12-gauge target gun. Probably a trigger plate action because they're the best, pretty much, in terms of reliability and probably the coolest.
Gauge? Are you sticking with a 12-gauge?
Yeah, 12. 12 all day long. Yeah, I mean, again, not very adventurous, I know, but it allows for a much broader scope, doesn't it? Because I can stick sub-gauge barrels on this dream gun. Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm not completely sure that what I'm going to end up with is going to be my dream gun, but it sure would be something interesting to see and to shoot a little bit. I'm sure about that.
Yes. Yeah, that's probably the right way of putting it. You're not building a dream gun here, because actually, both of us, if you asked us our dream gun, it's definitely going to be nothing like what we're discussing.
So let's start with the barrels. We're going to move from tip to tip on this. So let's start with the barrels. My build is going to have a two-barrel set. Both barrels are going to come from Longthorn because obviously I watch too much of your YouTube channel. Longthorn is, of course, famous for milling their barrels from a solid block of premium steel. There's no joining or soldering. It's all one piece. My first set will be a 32-inch barrel set with solid side ribs and a slightly tapered top rib, maybe something like 11 millimeter down to 8 millimeter. I've discovered lately that I prefer a slightly wider rib, even on a game gun. My second set of barrels, I think, is going to be a little bit more interesting. They're again going to be from Longthorn, but this set would be 28 inches long, have solid side ribs again, but would be ribless. I guess more accurately, they would be a copy of kind of the Boss style quarter rib design. For those who aren't familiar with that, you basically have a 3 or 4 inch rib section at the breech end of the barrels that then terminates, and then you have no rib running the entire length of the barrels. You would have an island ramped rib at the muzzle end of the barrels that's just a few inches long where the front bead is installed. But generally speaking, they are ribless. And then just because I can, I think I'd want that front bead to be a genuine ivory ball, like my old LC Smith specialty grade. So an ivory bead, just because I can.
The fact you're going to go for an ivory bead, kind of, that's pretty cool. I mean, what I'm going to produce is less classy than what you're going to produce. I think you've set a standard here. So barrels. Firstly, set of barrels. It's going to be hard, right? I shouldn't have chosen a target gun. Target guns are yobby, aren't they? They're very unelegant, generally speaking. And so a lot of the things I'm going to say might not belong on a target gun, but we're going to go for it anyway. We're going to have a 32-inch set of barrels by Beretta. We were lucky enough to go and have a make a film with Beretta at their factory on how they make their barrels. I made a couple of throwaway comments. They weren't throwaway comments. They were probably a little bit rude thinking back on it. Basically saying I thought all of their barrel technology was just marketing and horse poo. And so they said, come on, we'll show you. And it was insane. The amount of money invested in those barrels is wild to me. Absolutely wild to me. And I would be proud to have a set of their tubes on this gun. I would have it's so hard not to have a solid top and mid rib. It's kind of heartbreaking, but it's a target gun. So we'd have a vented top rib, 11 mil to 8 mil with a tram line down the middle. The bead sight, I'd probably go beadless to be honest, or a very, very small bead in the end. And whilst we're putting shiny things in the end, I once put a ruby bead in the front of somebody's gun as a custom job years ago. And it was so small that you could barely see it. And I remember thinking, that's really nice. Barely protruded out the top. It was just enough that you could use it as a little poking piece. And now you've inspired me to have some kind of exotic, expensive, small nugget on the end of my gun. That would be quite cool. But probably I would go beadless and holeless on this sporting gun. Though a tiny little bead at the end wouldn't go amiss, I suppose.
So you and I both mentioned the top rib taper. At least I did in my 32-inch barrel set. I've never really thought that I cared that much about a top rib being too narrow until I had a gun in for review recently. It was a long-barreled over-and-under field gun. And the top rib terminated at 4 millimeters. I could not get used to shooting it. I know you're not supposed to see it. I know you're not supposed to pay attention to it, but it distracted me.
No. I think that's a load of rubbish, right? You are supposed to see it. It's there. It's obvious. It's a huge thing that's in your face that you can see. Anyone who says you don't see it, I mean, most of the top shooters are barrel aware. There's very few who shoot with an invisible gun, but I also don't believe that they shoot with an invisible gun.
Yeah.
All these little things do make a difference. Sorry, I'll get up. I'll shut up.
No. And I think that most of the time, I think that with somewhat more typical dimensions, that top rib does just kind of fade away and you don't see it. On this gun, I just couldn't get used to it. And I was almost sort of fixated on this ultra narrow and what appeared to be a really high top rib. If I remember it right, it was an 11 millimeter to a 4 millimeter tapered rib. It was just very
11 to four. Who makes an
11 to four?
Who makes an 11 to four?
It was a Zoli. It was the Pernice, and I measured it.
Whoa! Yes, it's not a true 11 to four, is it? Because it's got that hyper taper at the back, right?
Right. Right, you're exactly right. Yeah. It's an 11, and then it immediately tapers quickly down to what, like 8?
Yeah, I would say from 7 or 6. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. It kind of flares.
Yeah, I didn't hate that gun. I didn't hate that rib, but I think when you have ribs like that, it has to be shot very, very flat, right? You don't want to see that rib. That rib's not designed to be seen. You're designed to just have a bead appear over the top of a gun and magically stare it into existence, which is a totally probable thing. Obviously, with a flat shooting gun, that's what they're for. But yeah, I find most thin ribs don't want to be seen particularly, right? So on my rib would not be a flat rib. My rib would be a ramped tapered rib, probably from a Krieghoff Supersport, that kind of style, for anyone who's aware of what that looks like. Maybe even a concave ramped rib like is on for the sake of continuity, a Krieghoff Trap or a 682X Trap or a Browning XT, I think they call it now. That would be what I'd go for, a step up rib. I'm a big fan. It's a target gun. We'll go for it. But I would have a second set of flat rib, slightly lighter weight, fixed choke barrels to go with it. If we're allowed spare barrels. I didn't even realize that was a thing.
Sure we are. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I would probably have that to add to versatility so I could go and shoot game with it. Because, I mean, I say that I was shooting ducks last week with a Krieghoff, with a raised Super Sport rib. And I was like, this won't work. And it worked absolutely perfectly. Probably better than most things I've shot. But, yeah, that's what I would go for. And in terms of mid-rib, I'd probably go into vented. Why not? The barrel hanger system that's on a Krieghoff is fantastic, but a vented mid-rib is just a little, it's where I'd go, you know? Don't need to explain.
Yeah. I think that just from a standpoint of aesthetics, I think the profile of an over and under with solid side ribs is just a beautiful thing.
Oh, no doubt. And a solid top rib as well on a field gun over and under is such a hard thing to do well. I am a big fan.
So moving on from the barrels of the gun, let's go ahead.
Well, I thought we were going to do chokes. Did you cover chokes?
Yeah. I'm sorry. Both of my barrels will have a set of flush choke tubes. I wish I was ready to just go with fixed chokes, but I still would probably opt for a set of choke tubes. Tell me about the chokes that you would choose for your gun.
I'd have one as fixed choke, but I'd get it regulated to my favorite cartridge. I think that's quite an important thing. I'd have actually some barrel work done to the choke, but they're both Beretta barrels. They've both got monstrous amounts of back boring. I'd have a fixed choke one on the flat rib, and I'd have a multi-choke one on the other, and I'd probably put a pair of Teague hyper-extended bronze non-knurled chokes in the end. They do throw great patterns, but they're just beautiful. They've got this. If I said like Michael Kors to you, you know, that kind of dark rose gold bronze, they do in that color with no texture on the outside. And I've always just thought that looks like a beautiful thing.
So when you say that the choke tubes would be regulated to your favorite cartridge, that's kind of new to me. I'm sure other people know about dialing your chokes in that precisely, but I've never really gotten that deep into it. Is that pretty common over there?
Oh, it's a full geek loser thing. It's one of those things that it's beyond the marginal gains theory. But if you have the money and the time, certainly with a fixed choke gun, it's worth doing because the matter of one or two thou and a fixed choke gun with your favorite cartridge will make a difference. But what's interesting, I was speaking to the guys over at Teague a few months ago, and they're working with another mate of mine to really hyper develop the chokes for his gun as a trap shooter. and they're working up in 1 thou increments just to make sure that they're getting optimal performance. And I made a throwaway stupid comment once again. They seem to come out of my mouth in droves about it just being a complete waste of time. And they're like, no, like genuinely, you're not talking about major pattern changes. You know, not talking changing the spread by masses, but it can really affect consistency of patterns having 2, 3, 4 thou more. So, you know, instead of it being a 10 thou for improved cylinder, you're looking at, let's make it an 11.5 thou. That's what I want for when I'm shooting that range of target. Or instead of chucking a full in there because it's not making the best patterns, which is 40 thou, let's chuck a 37 thou in there. And they've been really dialing it in. I'm like, if I had the money and the time, why not? Why not?
Yeah. Yep. You've thought about that in way finer detail than I have. I'm assuming that yours, being a target gun, you'd go with ejectors on it?
Oh, yeah, why not? Why not? I don't need them. Definitely don't need them, but it is cool to ping them out occasionally.
Yeah, I think I'd have ejectors on my longer set of barrels, but I think I'd go with extractors on the ribless set, just to be different.
You're thinking that ribless set, that belongs in the grouse woods, walked up stuff where you don't need to be throwing them in the grass.
100% agree. Yep.
I borrowed a gun from Mr. Reinhold, a lovely Dixon box lock, and I was lucky enough to go and shoot some walked up grouse earlier this year. And for Simon, it's strange that it was an ejector gun, and I shot it, and I love cybersides, but it's the gun that made me truly understand why people are that passionate, because I was hunting with it, and it's hard to get passionate with a cyberside shooting clays because it's not the best tool for the job. And I apologize to everyone who doesn't agree with that. But when I do see one, when they become the dominant force, then they're clearly the best. But hunting with one in a walked up fashion.
Yeah, it's hard to beat.
And shooting it well on hard birds, hard wild birds, was unbelievable. But it was an amazing experience and way, way easier to shoot in that situation than any over and under I've ever shot. But the point in this was it was ejector, and about towards the end of the day, I'd slowed up. I got lucky with my position and I could shoot that gun quite well. So I was well into what I should have shot and I was taking it very easy. I just broke the gun and walked and watched everyone else for a bit. But after about an hour of walking and not having shot anything, I was like, we probably need to shoot a couple more because it's been a little quiet and there's been a few misses. Bird gets up on my feet, bang. Bird then flies down the line. I had a true left and right, quality left and right. And if I was in America, I would have punched the air and said yee-haw, but I didn't. So I just cracked the top lever and cracked the gun and had the cartridge go over my shoulder. And as soon as I thought that, did it, I was like, I best pick those up. It's really hard to find cartridges, black cartridges on a relatively dark green background.
Yeah. Especially here in the Midwest, where I most often hunt, we hunt a lot of CRP, which are warm season native grasses that are kind of promoted by the Conservation Reserve Program. This stuff is super thick and tangly. You can look down and literally lose your boot, let alone an empty shot shell hull. Now, I will say that with regards to extractors, Benelli, with their new 828U, it's on the Upland model, I'm sure. I'm not sure if it's on their other models. They have a new high-lifting extractor. And to me, that's interesting because the only real drawback of hunting with a gun with extractors is that when they don't lift out high enough to be able to easily and quickly get them out, especially with a gloved hand, you can run into some problems. We'll see if this new design catches on with other field guns.
What, in 20 or 12?
They actually offered them both. But I haven't got to use it yet, so we'll have to see if it lives up to its billing.
Yeah. I think when it comes to the extractor part of a gun, it's an interesting question about what extractor system you'd use. Have you gone that deep in your thought level process, or what ejector system you'd use?
No, I haven't.
There's a few makers who have made ejectors you can turn into extractors.
Right.
None of them have been that good. And I should be careful what I say now, because most, there will be something that I've missed that was actually all right. None of them have been that good. And so, and if they were, people would make them en masse. I think that's fair to say. I'm trying to think, a lot of people have tried it. But that would be a cool concept. Like, if you could have an ejector, you could turn it into an extractor relatively easily and have a reliable system, that would be a better option all round. But I don't think...
There you go. So, I mean, if there are any manufacturers listening to this podcast, you've just gotten a tip from Johnny Carter on what to bring to the market next.
Yeah, wasn't it the 690 when it came out had it? But it just isn't a great system. It's a little twisty thing.
Yeah, and I think the selector was actually under the fore end. It would be really great if it was just simple and quick to select.
Yeah, it's not quick. I swear I saw a system on an old side-by-side once that had it on the fore end and you could just push it and it actually locked the ejector springs in place. Not that interesting. Let's move on.
With the barrels covered, let's get into the middle of the gun, the action. I've already said that mine is going to be a side lock. What kind of details can you give me on the action of your shotgun?
What side lock? Did you say that?
Yeah, so my side lock would be a Boss design, which is the original John Robertson design. John Robertson, for those who don't know, was an actioner for James Woodward and Sons before going on to become the manager and then eventually the owner of Boss shotguns. The Woodward over and under side lock design then came out just a few years after the Boss, and that's what we see on Purdy over and unders built for really probably the past 100 years. Boss is still producing that original John Robertson design today in their over and under side lock shotguns.
And it is stunning, right? Like, I think as side locks go, the shape of the lock in their over and under is nice. I think nowadays there are nicer looking lock profiles, but the internal mechanism of a Boss over and under side lock and the overall look and feel and the way it locks, it's spanking, isn't it? Absolutely spanking.
Yep. They're beautiful. I guess we can go ahead and describe it for someone who's not familiar with the design, why this was so groundbreaking. On side-by-sides, which were the common guns of the day, the barrels hooked into the action with two lumps that hung down underneath the barrels. That extra depth that was added to the profile of the action, it's not very noticeable when you're dealing with a side-by-side. But when you're talking about an over and under, where the barrels are already stacked, that added height was much more of a problem. John Robertson devised a system where the lumps were actually on the sides of the bottom barrel and nothing really hung down below, right?
Yeah. I mean, how many thousands of guns now are produced on a monthly basis by gun makers with inspired hinge systems? More or less.
Yeah, about all of them.
More or less. Well, other than Browning, obviously, because, you know.
Yeah. Maybe Merkel is another exception.
No. They're still hinged below the barrels, although there aren't many over and under Merkels being sold now, I guess.
Yeah.
And to the same effect, you can still buy a AOA Augusta sidelock, I think, that has that same bottom thing. And I don't think it's actually... It took me a while to learn to love them. Or to learn to appreciate them is probably a better word. I don't hate them. I think when you first see one of those, like the Ovundo from Wesley Wristeds, or, I mean, I think there was in Holt's sale about a year and a bit ago, they had four or five English guns of a similar patent, similar trying that bottom hook design. And they're not elegant, but they are all right looking. I mean, you have to give them something. You have to at least see them for what the people who made them saw.
Yeah.
Because they didn't make them ugly on purpose. Well, maybe they did. I don't know.
I've just always been partial to over and unders with a shallower action. In my early years of exploring everything that was new to me with shotguns, I always preferred Beretta to Browning. I wasn't able to explain back then why, but I just like the way that the Beretta barrel sat lower in the action. It's just a different design. I know that There is many people out there that prefer the way a Browning feels in hand over a Beretta. So, I mean, just to each his own, I guess.
Yeah. What's interesting about the Browning is that he made the system slightly better. He, or Val, the Browning family, made it slightly better because instead of trying to hold the hook inside the action body, they put a cutout. And that lost you like 3 or 4 mil, which you say isn't a lot, but when you actually measure up guns, and I went through a phase, and I think we didn't make a video on it, but it would be interesting to like you and me and about a dozen other people who who find the kind of actual details fascinating.
I'd love
if you got a set of vernier calipers and you went in and you mic'd up every gun in terms of height and width and made a database, you'd be truly surprised what 2 mil of action width can do to the look and feel of a gun. And you look, Beretta's a good example here, that they used to produce thick actions and thin actions for their sporting and game guns. I mean, they now make completely different actions, but they were like 2 mil different. You look at Perazzi, similar. You've got like 2 mil and 1 mil difference in the action body, and it's a different beast altogether. It's cool.
And that dimension extends both forwards and backwards.
Yeah.
It's going to extend forward and dictate the initial profile of the forend, and it'll extend back to set up the profile of the wrist of the stock, or at least the dimension of the headwork of the stock. They aren't isolated just to the action
for sure
body. So let's move on now to your to the action type of your gun. You said it would be a trigger plate box lock, right?
Whilst having these conversations, I really don't know with the action. This is one of the hardest things because there are so many great ones, right? And we're talking about picking the best of the best and sticking it all together. What is the best action? I mean, this is truly hard because actions are tough. What are we classifying is good things about an action? From a side lock perspective, I get the whole side lock thing. Side locks are fascinating. They're less reliable, generally speaking, than trigger plate actions because of the way they're built and because of the whole thing. Cue thousands of emails complaining about that comment. Sorry. But generally speaking, that's true. And if you're going to go side lock, I mean, realistically, it's got to be Holland or Boss in an over and under if we're talking about being particularly special. And when you say Holland, you can almost include the SO series in there as well because, well, they kind of birthed from the same womb, essentially, where they weren't. One was basically copied from the other in the grand scheme of things. But when it comes to other actions, trigger plates or box locks, there are very few box lock over and unders that are truly box locks. Crikey. What are we classing as best? Well, what parameters do you bring in place to be best? This is the one I struggled with most. With barrels, it's relatively easy. With actions, I mean, crikey. I don't know. We could put an amalgamation in, and if we go put an amalgamation in, it would be a box lock because I'd choose a Krieghoff action. And it's not to say the Krieghoff action isn't bombproof, but I really fell in love with the internals of the Beretta SL3, and so I'd have an SL3 trigger unit put in it. And I'd know that's not actually a possibility because the Krieghoff action is a box lock, not a trigger plate action, and, well, the SL3 is a detachable trigger.
When you say Krieghoff action, are you including the sliding top latch?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's why it's so good, right? It's absolutely bombproof, creates a perma seal around the back of it. They are about the hardest wearing gun out there in the grand scheme, maybe along with something like a DT11, and that's in a similar kind of ilk in terms of strength. The Browning's a fantastic action, but from a long-term servicing point of view, it's harder and actually takes a bit more skill to do, and that's not an issue, but it's also nice that something's easy to work on. And a Krieghoff isn't potentially as easy as a DT. But, this was the thing I'd struggled with most. There's nothing wrong with a Krieghoff action, right? I actually think they're beautiful. It's a huge canvas. I like a side plate, don't get me wrong. But we all know that it's just fakery. It's just glitz and glamour. Nothing wrong with glitz and glamour, right? There's nothing wrong with that at all. I love a side plate. I own 3 of them, maybe 4, and they're fantastic. But a Krieghoff is a little more honest. And actually, this is so hard because I really think the Beretta SL series is really good too, as is the DT11. as is the Krieghoff. I couldn't pick between the three of them. Let's have all three. Why not?
While we're on the topic of action, let me get off into the weeds just a little bit.
Please do. It's my.
I've had a weird interest in some of the alternate methods of opening the barrels lately. We're all familiar with the ubiquitous top lever that you swipe with your thumb to open the barrels. I can't remember if this was a Purdy patent or if it belongs to Wesley Richards, but everybody knows what I'm talking about. There were others that were invented too, though. There was the snap action, under levers, all sorts of mechanisms were thought up to open the barrels. Some were good, some were bad. Some worked, but some required way too much hand movement and didn't really allow the shooter to maintain kind of a natural grip or hand position. Something like the Darn really comes to mind with its complicated sliding breech design. One of my favorites, though, is the side lever. I think this is a very kind of intuitive motion, and it really doesn't require you to change the position of your hand at all. I actually own a Henry Atkins side lever side lock and love the way that the side lever functions. You just swipe it down with your right thumb. I know that, again, Boss has just rolled out an over and under with the side lever. So to stay a bit unpredictable on this episode, I'm going to build my gun with, are you ready for this? I'm going to go with the interesting design that is found on some Manufrance shotguns. Now, I've never owned one or actually used one, but if you haven't seen them before, they're sort of a short tang that protrudes off the rear of the trigger guard. And then simply squeezing that with your ring finger upwards towards the wrist opens up the barrels. I've always been kind of fascinated with these, so I'm going to give Manufrance a nod on my Frankenstein gun. I honestly don't know what that design would be called. Maybe a squeeze action? I don't know.
I don't know what the patent's called. Probably squeeze grip or something like that. But I don't know what the correct nomenclature is for that.
Well, I think it's just fitting. This is a Frankenstein build after all. So yeah, I have a Woodward that has that snap action. It's actually has a small protruding lever off the trigger guard that you push forward, kind of with your thumb. It's not terrible, but it requires your hand to get kind of completely out of that ready position. I really like the gun, but I just don't like that mechanism as well as some others.
Yeah, they're quite nice.
I think that the Manufrance squeeze action would be kind of nice to try. So if anybody is listening and you haven't seen a Manufrance, just jump onto Guns International and check out what we're talking about. None of them are going to be amazing shotguns to look at, but you can at least see what that squeeze action is all about.
They did make guns that were amazing to look at. It's probably worth saying. But like a lot of makers, you just get so used to seeing the dross that they produce that you forget that these guys, again, at Holtz, which is where I see most of my insanely cool rare guns because that's where they all live, I saw Manufrance or two now that you would happily own and be proud of owning. And that isn't a comment I put out regularly. That's a lie. Again, all of these loading systems are a bit dickish, for lack of a better describing word, until you've used them a lot. And I remember we did that film with Simon and that beautiful pair of hammer guns, and that opening system was not particularly intuitive, but you do it enough and it just becomes second nature. And when you said about that, put the push down, the snap action, I've shot a few snap actions. The thing I find most interesting is actually the little reset helps. It stops you throwing away shots. And I know that sounds stupid and I'm hanging out with Simon too much. It does allow you to focus and take things a little more seriously. It does slow you down, and that's not a bad thing.
That's a good point.
Potentially. Given that most of the ones I've shot are non-ejector as well, realistically, you're going to have to take your hand out of the battery, give the gun to your loader, take the next one, and shoot. In an ideal world.
Yeah. Did we miss any details on the action? I'm going to move on to triggers next. You can start us off with triggers. I would assume your gun won't have a double trigger, but you can give us the details.
I know a single trigger, preferably mechanical. Again, there's nothing wrong with the Krieghoff trigger. In fact, it's a fantastic, fantastic unit. However, there's something about the compactness of the SL3 trigger unit that I find very attractive. And there's something about the fact of it being like the culmination of there are other trigger units. It's just the next generation, but with all of the love and attention that Brett Adoue gives stuff, that I did find very, very interesting. And there's nothing about this whole project that is saying that one gun isn't already perfect, because there's plenty of almost perfect guns out there. And this isn't about building a perfect gun. This is about saying, I like this component. I want it in this gun. So I would have the SL trigger unit in there. I would have a fixed trigger blade. I would have it slightly canted right. I would probably have some engraving on the back of the trigger blade itself. Don't know what, but I've always thought that's quite a cool thing. Saw it once. I was like, that's amazing. It's a bit like a friend of mine has a diamond on the inside of his wedding ring. I thought that's a really cool thing just for you. Nobody notices it.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen engraving on the back of a trigger. That's interesting. I did have a higher grade Darn. It was a V19 16 gauge years back. Oh, yeah. This thing had what looked like candy striped triggers that were alternately blued and browned. And I was told by someone that it was an indicator so that you would know when your gun was in need of service, or at least when enough time had gone by or use had gone by that it needed some service. When that striping wore off, it was time to send it in. Now, I've never verified that, so I've never seen anything like that since.
Hey, knowing Don, it was probably a mistake.
on my triggers. In keeping with the Beretta theme, a few years ago, Beretta unveiled something that I think that they called a double single trigger.
Oh, yeah.
If you haven't seen this before, it basically looks like a standard double trigger, but it's magic. The first pull of the front trigger fires the first barrel. If you pull the front trigger again, it fires the second barrel. If you pull the back trigger first, it fires the second barrel first. And if you pull it a second time, it fires the first barrel. I think it's infinitely more useful than the conventional barrel selector that's, you know, often found in the safety slide that everybody's familiar with, but probably no one ever really uses it in a hunting situation, or you know, when a bird flushes. This trigger mechanism installs in any Beretta 680 series shotgun. I think 12 gauge only, and it's been out for a few years, but I haven't gotten to try one yet. Beretta, if you're listening, send me one. I think these things are like $200. I think
that there's totally
probably a pretty decent market for these in the United States. Johnny, have you had a chance to try one of these out? Have you ever seen one or used one?
Yeah, so we were out filming at a place called Catchia Village, which was an amazing hunting gun show in Bastia Umbra in the middle of Italy. Beautiful place. More importantly, the only gun show I've ever been to with a 5-million-star restaurant. It was unbelievable. Like a game-themed restaurant with the best game food you've eaten in your life. And it wasn't cheap by any means, but it wasn't super expensive. It was just great food. And they had, anyway, that's not the point. Beretta was there. They had all of their stuff. And they were like, have you seen one of these? I'm like, no, I'm English. And he talked me through it. I'm like, that is awesome. And there's not a great call for that kind of thing over here, for sure. But for walked up hunting, why not, right? You don't know. If you're in thick cover and a woodcock gets up, bang. If you're out in some thin grass and a covey of partridges gets up, different situation, right?
Exactly. I honestly never use a barrel selector, and honestly wish that most of my guns probably didn't even have one. I think this is a really interesting way around that.
And we're not all as good as you, man. Some of us need two barrels, okay? So if we need that.
I've never said that. Now, but the only thing that I think that I might be marginally good at is buying shotguns, probably too many shotguns.
Yeah, part of the fun of it, though, isn't it? Owning a cabinet full of junk that no one else appreciates.
Absolutely. I just back to that trigger. I just think that that's a clever way around that barrel selector.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't want a selector, but I would probably run the same chokes in each barrel regardless. So it's kind of a pointless thing for me, given what I do with a gun at least.
Well, that's going to do it for part one. Make sure you're on the lookout for part two of this strange but hopefully interesting conversation coming out in the next few days, where we're going to detail things like engraving, stock and fore-end types, wood character and figure, and even the cases that we'll tote these monstrosities in. As always, thank you so much for listening.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of A Break in the Action. Want to hear your voice on a future episode? Leave a message, ask a question, or suggest a topic on our listener line at 317-662-4520. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook, and visit us at abreakintheaction.com.